Okay, so let's start with today's compiler construction. Welcome, everybody. Last time we left off with the result of a run of the Berry-Sethi algorithm, and that would provide us the automaton that you see on that slide. So it delivers on the promise that the number of states is given by the number of letters that were found in the original regular expression plus one additional state, and we see now what that state was needed for. It was the start state. That's already something at least. We have an automaton by that. However, we can see that we might have also got something like that, which is very more compact than the version that we've seen on the slide before. That might have been even a preferred version, but can't have everything right from the box. There's alternative approaches to compute more compact automata than the Berry-Sethi automaton does. So that would be a hint to look out for in the world of publications. There's a concept that is called the Antimirov automaton or the follow automaton, and both of them promise to be even more to yield even more compact automata than the algorithm that we've seen on last time. However, they are also a little bit more complicated, so that might be something for a topic in the workshop at the end of the semester. The Berry-Sethi thing is something that, which is in that sense quite nice, as it is almost directly constructed from the syntax tree and follows the principles that we get from this kind of bottom-up approach in just constructing little parts and then assembling larger parts from that until we reach the complete automaton. The thing is that at that point we still have a non-deterministic automaton, and as soon as we want to actually determine whether a word is accepted by an automaton, we need some kind of deterministic procedure. We can't just repeat over and over again with our automaton taking different branches each time until we at some point maybe reach an accepting state. That would be rather silly. So we would actually prefer some kind of deterministic method to deal with our automata. So the thing that you've learned in the theoretical computer science for that, well, it's already mentioned over here, is power set construction. Does anybody in here not know what power set construction is all about? Yeah, so maybe it was not for nothing that I have a short recapitulation on that. So in an example, what would we do for power set construction? We would try to trace all the states that are reachable for a certain input and combine them into a new in a combined state, one of these power set states, and interpret the transition between the original state and the other one as just only one transition anymore, thus eliminating the choice between several possibilities for the same transition label. And with that, we would try to cover all the paths that are possible in the original automaton and see what we get. And in general, we get quite a lot of states out of that because, well, you can imagine if you combine several states into one, there's a lot of possible combinations out there. You can combine them arbitrarily, thus creating a large space of possible power sets, states, and in principle that would be an exponential an exponential problem space. So in the example here, we would start from the original from the original start state and pick an arbitrary edge label, for example A here, and trace all the states to which we can transition to from the original state. So we would pick both of these A states and check what we can reach with that. And what we can reach with that is this state and this state. So in our newly constructed power set automaton, what we will do is we will introduce only one single transition with that label and put all the states that we could reach via that label in the original non-deterministic automaton and call the new automaton like that. So we only have one transition anymore, thus eliminating the choice between two, thus getting rid of that part of non-determinism. Yeah, so we can repeat that also with the next remaining thing, which is the transition B. So we would introduce a new transition B somewhere else and try to cover all the states that are reachable with B, and we see that from the start state we can only reach one, which is this one here, and that by itself is also, of course, it's also a power set just containing one original non-deterministic automaton. From that, we can go with A to 0 once again, and we can also go A and reach 2. Apart from that, we can reach nothing with A. So what we do is we introduce an A, and it has to go to a state that is labeled 02, sorry, the original names of the states. And turns out we already have such an such a state in there, so we use that one to connect to. And apart from that, there's also the B, which goes to 1, so we need to connect 1 with B to itself. So that thing remains in there. What else will be? Well, we have to continue with, for example, this one over here, 02. Now that is something different than before. This is this is related to two states from the original non-deterministic automaton. But the thing is, well, when we talk about what we can reach with A from this one, we have to talk about what we can reach from A from either of the original states. So if you go A from 0, we reach 0. If you go A from 0, we can also reach 2. And then keep in mind that we also have 2 to track. So from 2, we can go to 3 from with A from 2. So that would be the new state to go. And yeah, that's what we're going to get. Also, we see that I've already put the transition under A in there, which would just check for 0, 2, and 3, what we can reach with A, and that will just reach itself. And yeah, we proceed the same way through the remaining states until nothing changes anymore. And yeah, with that, we have found the new automaton, which is now deterministic, as it just has one outgoing edge per label. So there's no non-determinism anymore. epsilon edges haven't even been in the original automaton, so well, that's just a benefit. And finally, and yeah, so with that we get a deterministic automaton.
Excuse me.
Yes.
What is when you combine the states? When I start, I go to 0, 2, but there are two different states. How can you merge them?
Well, this, that is, you can reach either one of them in the original non-deterministic automaton with that.
So now I reach both of them?
Sorry?
Now what does it happen? I reach both of them or both?
The thing is that you might, in one run, reach the first one, and in the second run you might reach the other one. You don't know for sure. It's non-deterministic in the original. The semantics for a non-deterministic automaton is that it suffices that any run of or that just one particular run of the automaton reaches a final state. So we're not actually interested what concrete decision has been, but we're completely fine with getting just all the possibilities. And thus, this 0-2 is already fine for us because, yeah, well, haven't talked about the notion of the accepting states there. So because we, for us, it suffices that that just one run that reaches a final state, well, that you can reach a final state through a particular run through that thing. So we it suffices that one of the states that is captured with a power set state has been a final state, because, well, that might we can just say that we pick the run that has reached the final state and consider that as the run that we're on right now. So we're kind of doing all the runs at the same time. You could also see the whole thing as going as forking your process that tracks your progress through the automaton each time that you come to a point where you can do a non-deterministic decision. So if you start from here and have an input of A, you have an input of, for example, A. What's happening there? A, B, C. No, we don't have C, D. A, B, or something. You start over here with your marker, and now that you have to read A, you have two choices. So what you actually do is you fork, and you, instead of having just one marker anymore, you have one marker that goes the first possibility and the other marker that goes the second possibility. But you just do a step on each of the markers that you have, and if you have the possibility of forking, you do a fork. So you will possibly multiply the number of increase the number of markers at each step. And that corresponds to the combination of original states in the power set state. So it's just a question of how to have your view on the concept. Good. So with that, we can find a non-deterministic automaton for each. We can find a deterministic automaton for each non-deterministic one, and it will accept the same language with all the different. Yeah. Well, you mean that nodes that have that? Well, for those we implicitly have transitions to a collecting fail state, so to say. We just never put them on the on these diagrams there. And with that, well, if you incorporate that into your drawings, you get a lot of edges for everything that is not directly covered on there. But that would still hold, the, or would still be a valid construction of that thing. And yes, with that, you can get all the combinations. Good. So the construction of that thing is that the states of the final automaton is now... Yes, each time. It's now power sets of the old final automaton, of the old non-deterministic automaton. The start state is just the is just a set of the original states, and it's particularly the set of initial states. So, yeah, we just take this set of initial states from the definition of the non-deterministic automata and are fine with our start state. And the final states are those states out of the power states, out of the possible sets of states that have an intersection with the final states from the non-deterministic automaton that is non-empty. So if there's a final state in there, we mark the power set state also as a final state. And apart from that, our transitions are the way that we have seen. So if in the original delta, in the original transition relation, we have a transition from P to Q under A, and the P is in our start state, and we look at the transition under the label A, then all the Qs from there are gathered in the target state. So that's exactly what we have done so far. We have looked at all the states in our originating power set, checked whether there is a transition under the label A that we are currently interested in, and collected all the Qs into our new set, which then is the new state that we reach. Yeah, so in principle, we're done with that. We have a construction that gives us a finite automaton, a deterministic automaton. However, there's this slight remark that there is, if you talk about a power set construction, we have to keep in mind that a power set construction is always an exponential construction. So if we combine everything with everything, then we get exponentially many combinations out of that. And an exponential number of states, well, gives you a kind of an explosion, depending on how many states you had in the original non-deterministic automaton, of course. But that might be a hard thing to actually compute. So although in theory we have a method now to come up with a deterministic automaton, in practice we run into the problem of having exponentially many states in that automaton. No remark? Well, you could maybe ask for this one here, which looks, of course, very exponentially compared to the original one, didn't it?
Yeah. We only use the ones that are actually connected. Like, we use the states from the power set that are actually connected from the roots of the
So, yeah, that is actually the point. In principle, we have an exponential problem space here that we need to explore, but we don't explore all the combinations. We only try to uncover those that are actually reachable, that would be the term, from the initial state. So with that, we already get the first idea of optimizing that thing, which comes kind of intuitively, I would say. Probably nobody ever has tried to come up with all the combinations of power sets there in theoretical computer science. You probably have intuitively only constructed the contributing power sets, which is what is said in this remark over here. The idea would be not to to create all the power sets, but only the ones that are contributing in the sense that they are reachable from the start set. And only add by need. However, with that, you already drop a lot of these states. These can still be a lot of states, maybe not the whole exponential problem space, but it could be a large fraction of that. So there's no guarantee that you won't run into a very large automaton. So there's also other ideas that you can probably see in other working tools that have to actually deal with a lot of variations of regular expressions and all that. For example, this grep tool that you that the Unix people maybe know from command line. And for those, at least the last time that I have looked into that, the regular expressions deterministic automaton is actually never really created in there. So they stop at the point where they do the non-deterministic automaton, and then not try to create all the states that are actually reachable from the initial states, but only those states that are really needed to interpret the input that they are supposed to check at that moment. So they have a temporary representation of what they have reached so far through the transitions that are dictated by the input. And thus, if the input is very short, for example, and the automaton might be very large, the fraction of the automaton that is actually created is just corresponding to the length of the input. And considering that you have to read the input anyway in order to decide whether it is considered for appropriate for that regular expression or not, that's already a pretty good result, I would say. So while processing the input, you do the construction on the fly and kind of cache just the fraction of the automaton that you have needed for so far. So that's what is done in that case. Let's have a look at that once again with the with an example. And now we have a concrete input, and it's AB, AB. There's not so many letters to choose from. So the non-deterministic automaton is the same one that we have seen before. And now we try to do this construction by need. For that, we also, of course, start with the start state, and that has to be the one that gathers all the initial states from the original one. And yeah, from this, we are now motivated to explore what happens when we consume an A, and that was the branch that would go up there from last time. We already know that, so that would uncover that part of the automaton. Then we would have to go B, and B will, well, what do we reach from 0 and from 2 with B? From 0 we reach 1, and from 2 we reach B, so that will be probably this one over here. Yeah, so that is the one that's reached from there. Then it's A once again. A from 1 goes to 0. A from 4 does not go to anything. So that would be the implicit catch-all state that no one ever connects in there, but is always implicitly in there. And if you try to implement that, you will probably implement one of these catch-all states anyway. But yeah, so you just print a thing in there, and then it's B once again, and B will reach 1 and 4, which is already in there. And with that, we have only uncovered a part of the actual deterministic automaton, and that is bounded by the length of the input that we have read so far. And yeah. So that's what you can do in order to save computation time with that. So, resuming on that, with that, yeah, we get only maximally length of the input, many states from that. We can construct them on the fly, but since we don't have any guarantee that the states that we uncover are somehow contiguous in this state space, we can't use anything like a numeric table anymore for representing them. So we will probably go over to use a hash table in order to dynamically grow and to be able to map from any state that we uncover to whatever is necessary from that. So we will from then on use a hash table for those things. And in case that we uncover a new transition, we check whether we can already find the appropriate information in the hash table and only create a new entry and compute the new entry in case that is not already present. So it's just what you would expect the whole thing to do. And with that, we can compute a deterministic automaton that will have as input language the language that is associated with the regular expression. So, with all these techniques, we can now come back to our original problem and try to integrate all the techniques that we have seen so far into a concrete scanner. So, for those who have lost the overview on what we are actually after, scanner was the thing that would take definitions of token classes as input and generate a piece of code that would read an input file and generate a classified sequence of tokens, or no, better to say, a sequence of classified tokens. That is probably the better thing to say. And the way that that is actually realized in practice is, with maybe a little bit of configuration header and footer and all that involved. What you will see in most of these scanner creators is that or scanner generators is that you have a section where you have on the left-hand side a lot of regular expressions and on the right-hand side a lot of rules that tell you how to act in the situation that the scanner has consumed a token that corresponds to the definition of the token class on the left-hand side. And usually there's some way of also referring to the actual sequence of characters that has corresponded to that particular regular expression. And from there on, you can do whatever you would like to do with that token. In most cases, you will somehow just pipe them to a parser component afterwards, but there's also uses for directly performing an action at that point. So yeah, it's up to you. For example, you could do syntax highlighting with just a scanner in that way, by just putting out color codes as an action as well as the actual matched sequence of characters. So anyway, The semantics of the scanner that is created from that input would be a program that tries to find a maximum prefix, in this case called W, from the input that matches just one of these regular expressions that are provided on the left-hand side. So this prefix kind of matches the OR expression of all the regular expressions that are in that file. And the thing is, the one is chosen that or is chosen the regular expression that would lead to the match that would cover the most input characters, starting from the beginning of the thing. If there are several of them that would match a certain prefix, then the question is which of those will gonna fire its action. The semantics is that the action that has the minimum index I gets the priority on that. So the action I of that minimal index will be executed. So what does that typically incorporate? Well, you have with that a kind of a priority on the regular expressions. So the ones that are mentioned in front will get priority over the ones that are listed further down, at least in case if we're looking at a same length match. Of course, if the one that is at the bottom would match a larger fragment of the input, then the one at the bottom would get the precedence. So where does that typically happen? Well, consider a programming language with keywords and identifiers. An identifier would usually be declared as a sequence of characters and numbers at some point, probably. And a keyword, what is a keyword? A keyword is often usually just a particular sequence of characters, which would be actually a member of the language that could be that would be represent would represent the identifiers. So in case for the keyword to actually be matched at all, you would have to give the keyword a regular expression the priority by moving it actually up. So a good example would be, for example, the int thing in languages like C or Java or whatever. This one would match the identifiers or the keywords, but would be considered a keyword as it could. As the keyword int is listed further up in the scanner definition of C's scanner, for example. By contrast, if you would find something like the like integer in there, although the prefix int matches a keyword or a regular expression that is pretty much on top of the list of regular expressions, still the identifier would overrule that, because by matching with the identifier we would match the complete thing and not only the part that corresponds to the keyword. So the longer one gets the precedence. Okay. How can we do that? For that we would create the automaton for the concatenation, for the variation of all the regular expressions found in there. And that is something that you can could kind of do incrementally after having already created all the automata for the particular regular expressions. And you would then try to give the finite states in the resulting automaton different, so to say, colors or flavors or classes of tokens that are considered to be matched if you end up in such a finite state, and you would give these labels to those things depending on the order in which you have found them in the input file. So you would first of all consider the final states for the first regular expressions by selecting all the regular expressions from the selecting all the states from the final state and filtering with those that would be found in the last of the E1 subcomponent of that, and then continue on with the final states for the second regular expressions, for which you would take all the remaining final states and filter with the last set of the E2 component, and so on. And with that, you would kind of do a partition on your final states depending on the regular expression with which they would match. And with that, you would get these priorities into your scanner. So that's just a plain extension of what you've done so far. That's what you can use the last for. Yeah. So the only thing that now still we're missing now is the notion of how to get this longest match into the game. With that, we only have implemented the precedence and the longest match. Well, it's kind of a trial and error concept that we do for that. You would keep two pointers and related states in your memory at some point, and track your progress through the through the automaton on your input, and in case that you hit a final state at some point, you would kind of do a backup of that thing into your second component and continue on with consuming input while still keeping the pointer to the input and the state in your backup version. And in case you reach another final state, you would update both of those things. And in case you never reach anything like that anymore, but instead, for example, hit the catch-all failure state, then you would know from that point on you can't find any match anymore. So the one that you have kept in your backup is the one that you take. For example, let's assume that we have already consumed a little bit of the input successfully and are now in the process of trying to find the next thing. What we do is we would start with having nothing in the backup so far. We haven't found a real match, so we would consider the whole thing as pointing to the start of the input and having no valid final state here as the one that's considered with that. And we would start the whole thing with our start state, Q0, and point to the beginning. And now we would advance with both of those things. So first of all, we would advance with the B thing. So we would update the pointer to point to W at first, and then to R, then to I, then to T, and so on, and also rewrite the state that's associated with that thing. And only as when we reach a final state, we would do a backup of both of these things into our second set of pointer and state. And we do that each time that we reach such a final state. For example, in this one here, we would be in the final state 4 and be at position like that. And over here, we would see that from that state under the transition of white space, we wouldn't reach anything valid anymore. We would reach this kind of catch-all thing. You're now the catch-all guy. Yeah, anyway, but with that, we would have realized that we cannot find any valid match anymore, and thus we would consider this combination as the longest match and yield the final state like that, and consider the position as the one that corresponds to the final to this final state and to the longest match, and consume this bit and yield state 4 as our final state for that, and reset the whole process and restart by having no valid final state and restart from zero state, and consider that as the token that is classified with whatever corresponds to this state 4, probably identifier in that case, and yeah, are done with that. We would then be able to try to differentiate which of the regular expressions was the one that was responsible for that and call the appropriate action for that. So far, is there a question on that? Pretty straightforward then, I guess. Good. A little remark here, what you can also find in concrete scanners are so-called scanner states. And they are not a real extension in the sense of you get a more expressive scanner with these facilities, but they might ease your life a little bit because you can differentiate after having seen certain kind of markup tokens that you now want to consider a different set of rules to interpret all the stuff that you now encounter in your input, and at some point maybe move on to another subset and so on. And for that you would introduce the things that are called scanner states. The scanner states are collections of rules and actions and are given a kind of a name as an identifier, and in the actions of your rules you can switch to these new rule sets by sort of calling them with the identifier that you have given to this rule subset. That is something that is very useful for things like comments. Why is that? Well, comments usually are realized with certain tokens, for example, in the C++ world or Java world, you have these two slashes, or yeah, those two things. And before, something like a while would have been considered to be a keyword, but after we have seen such a double slash thing, we have now kind of entered this comment world, and then inside that there's other rules at stake, and there we won't interpret while as anything special, but just plain comment. The only thing that really is of interest to us is the point where we reach the actual new line or line feed, and only then we would stop with the whole thing. So the rule set for a comment would consist of interpret everything as the same, ignore it basically, or gather it as the actual comment. Only if we encounter a new line, then switch back to the original state where we have the common C or C++ or Java or whatever we came from rules, and apply them until we, of course, once again encounter the comment introducing token, and then we switch back to the comment state. I think, yeah, we have an example of how that might look like in practice. So in general, what you get now is you get the collection of regular expressions that define the token classes. You get the actions, and in these actions you get certain method calls. They're called YY begin. Don't ask me why it's specifically YY begin. That's a kind of a historical thing and has been used in the 70s, 80s already for the YAC and BSON parser generators, and it's just now kind of the standard of what you use there. And you can, in those, use the identifiers that you have given to certain groups of rules as their state as their state names, and with this YY begin you would switch to the new rule set with that. Although such a thing looks like a method call, and with a method call we would kind of connect some notion of returning at some point. Please be careful here. That is not a method call here. We don't have a notion of context or stack or something involved in that here. We do a plain state switch here. States don't themselves don't keep track of the path that we have taken through the automaton that has reached that. They're just plain states. So if we are once switched into the other state, we need to encounter another YY begin with a new state denominator in order to switch state again. So there's no notion of returning otherwise. In an example, you would, for example, have the comments, and yeah, in there, it might look like that. That's the YY initial state. That is usually the name of the standard set of rules that is supposed to be valid in the beginning of the file until the first state switch happens. And there might, of course, be a lot of other rules which I haven't put on the slide over here. But one of those would be the token class, which is just one specific character sequence that would be treated as the keyword that initiates the context switch. And all that this does is switch into the comment world by doing a context state switch with YY begin comment, and this would lead to comment being the actual state of the scanner right now, and this would wait for the termination symbol, which is this star slash combination. And in that case, we would go back to our initial rule set. And in case of everything else, we have a catch-all symbol here, which is this dot. That is a flex internal code, or a new line in that case. And in those cases, we, in this case, wouldn't do anything. We would just ignore what we find over here. Okay, so that is scanner states. Nifty little tool for all the people who are practically using these scanner states, and you can imagine that that is just something that you can pretty easily realize as soon as you have constructed the automaton for the rule set or for the regular expressions from the rule set of that state. And if you encounter such a YY begin with a state name, you would just connect the state for the final state for that particular regular expressions automaton with the initial state of the automaton that corresponds to the identifier that is used in that thing. Yeah?
So right now we just have star and slash, which is the end of the comment without actually starting the comment, and it would still be initial state without an error.
Which is, you're referring to a certain input, aren't you? You have.
If you just have the second rule from the three rules, the second rule.
So this one would not be in there.
No, so not the first one. I'm just looking at the second one. Uh-huh,
okay.
Just read the file and then find a star and a slash, then it will jump into the initial state, even if it wasn't in the initial state and there is no error.
It would jump to the initial stage. Yeah.
Okay.
But in this case, it's already the common state. Because the first time.
Ah, okay, so it was a misreading here, yeah. So, thank you, I didn't get what the problem actually was. No, you have to consider that thing as a union, or not a union, but belonging together. So, that is the name for the collection of rules. Over here. Good. Okay. So, yeah. I think that's nothing that I haven't said already. So, with that, that's probably all the exciting things that have that are working in the very front of the compiler. Now that we have come up with a way of generating such a scanner module. The question is, what do we do with the classified tokens now? And that is the purpose of the syntactic analysis part of the front end of a compiler. So, just to rekindle the idea that we had for this component, what we get from the scanner is the classified tokens in form of a stream as input. Then we have a component that we call the parser, and this would produce a result that would reflect the syntactic structure of the token stream, and that is something that is usually done in the form of a syntax tree in some way. So the purpose of that is that you would move away from these very little units of meaning that are the tokens and create larger ones that are associated with certain meanings in your program. What does that mean? Well, for example, you could consider something like a loop as a syntactic unit of your program. But that is not the smallest unit that's out there. Of course, a loop consists of the keyword, for example, while, then it has brackets, it has a condition, it has a body, it has the body itself is consisting of statements, and all of those are smaller units of meaning, might not be the smallest ones out there, might themselves also be compositions of other units, but those are your structural units of your program, and the syntax tree assembles them all together in one big hierarchy, starting from your input file as kind of the parent of everything, and in there you would find then, for example, in the Java world, you would find the block of imports, then you would find the set of classes in there with one main class. A class is then consisting of keywords and name and the class body, which itself then consists of, and so on. And that is the syntactical structure of your program, and that is what the parser should give you. So, yeah, that's what we already have covered in free speech. So, pretty similar to the way that we have talked about the scanner combination, we can once again, of course, go the hard way and try to come up with a parser by ourselves. So, is there anyone who has tried such a thing? Not yet. Okay. So there's. Now I'm talking to people who haven't really experienced the pain of trying to come up with such a program themselves. But there's the naive way of trying that, and then there's also a way that makes it quite easy for you if you follow certain programming concepts. However, as this is quite repetitive and might be quite a nuisance to do, there's once again the concept of applying a generator on a very concise specification that provides you with the complete component, the parser. And for our cases, well, I think we have already talked about what is behind that. The way of specifying syntactical concepts, at least in our case, is the context-free grammar. So you would provide a set of context-free rules, maybe also together with a few actions, what should actually happen whenever you match where you find such an instance of such a rule. And the generator would then go on and create a meaningful program for that is able to efficiently create structure out of a token stream. And, as we have once again a concept of theoretical computer science here on the left-hand side as the input, which is the context-free grammar, well, you maybe still remember from your days of theoretical computer science that there's the concept of a push-down automaton that is on the same level as the context-free grammar in terms of input that it can consume. And so the expressiveness of both of these concepts are the same. The grammar is a good way for us to specify how we want structure to be like. Just consider natural language grammars. And push-down automaton is something which is pretty near to what is actually working in your computer already. So it's pretty easy to somehow emulate such a thing on current hardware. So that is a model which is quite suited for execution. So that would be probably a good combination of things to do, specify with grammars and let the whole thing come up with a convenient automaton for that. So, that's what we're going to see in the next few lectures. This will be essentially how to come up with pushdown automata from context-free grammars, and since that is something that's once again in theory an easy thing, but in practice turns out to have certain consequences, we will not have just plain pushdown automata, but pushdown automata with certain restrictions or extensions or whatever is necessary to get convenient performance in the generated component. So, once again, we need a few basic things to clarify between us in order to talk about the same things. And there's context-free grammars. Context-free grammars are talking about alphabet of terminals and non-terminals. So the first thing would be to clarify what we consider to be terminals and non-terminals in our setting. And since we produce a component that needs to consume tokens from a token stream, well, we can already consider that tokens will probably be the terminals in our pushdown automaton. So it's not input symbols, it's tokens that are the terminals for our produced component. Apart from the terminals, as soon as we start to introduce something like structure in there, we also need to somehow refer to those structural concepts, and for that we also introduce symbols that are not terminals and thus are called non-terminals. Those are these the names for the structural components that are larger than just simple units. For example, a loop or something would be the name of a non-terminal in there. So, on a formal way, what context-free grammars were defined as was several components. Context-free grammar has defined the terminals on which it works. It has non-terminals that are valid as intermediate nodes inner nodes in the parse tree of our, or syntax tree of our parser. Then there's a set of productions, also called rules. And then there's one particular non-terminal which is considered as mother of all, or the root symbol, or also the start symbol. So that is what we need for a context-free grammar. The productions need to be context-free rules, and those look like the ones that you see over here. A context-free rule consists of, well, a tuple in that sense. It has a left-hand side component, which is just consisting of one particular symbol, and this is the symbol needs to be out of the set of non-terminals. So it has a non-terminal on the left-hand side, and the right-hand side is now considered to be a combination of either non-terminals or terminals. So it's a string which can be whose letters can be chosen from the non-terminals or the terminals. The example would be our well-known well-matching brackets over here, which is the grammar over here. It has only one non-terminal and several terminals. Since we only have one non-terminal, it's the only one that's found on the left-hand side. It's the S. It goes to ASB, and on the right, on the second rule, there's I could also leave it free, but it's more explicit when I actually mention that there's the empty string, so I once again put the epsilon on there. And the language that is produced with that kind of production set is the one that has A's and B's after each other, with as many A's as it has B's. Well, as a side note, if you see me having rules of production rules on the slides, you will see me using blue for terminals and green for non-terminals. And usually the non-terminals, if they are just single letters, they will be capital letters. And if they are composed things, they get these kind of brackets around them. And terminals are considered to don't have any brackets or be lowercase letters. So that is the conventions that you will see throughout the productions, at least hopefully. So in a practical example from a concrete programming language, that would be a part or a fraction of some procedural language that is somehow similar to things like C. So here you would have a root symbol that is considered to be statement only. Statement would be an if or a while or a right-hand side expression. You see that there's already another meta symbol involved in here. that's this pipe thing. I introduced that in kind of a similar way as it has been for the regular expressions. It's an either or. You could also rewrite the same thing as just a statement will go to an if, or statement might go to a while, or statement might go to right inside expression. So that is just a short way of writing the same thing. It's just a variation of production rules. The if would be considered to be a combination of terminals and non-terminals. It would be considered as a keyword if together with the brackets and right-hand side expression, and then followed by a statement, keyword else, and once again a statement, and so on. So I think you get the notion of that. You can combine terminals and non-terminals to right-hand sides, and you would refer to the things that other non-terminals are able to produce by mentioning them at the positions where they can fit in. So that's the deal, how you can create the hierarchical structure of such a language. A few more conventions on that. So if we happen to talk about these kinds of things, we would probably not list each of the variations of production for a non-terminal at distributed over the complete page, but we will combine them into one of these variation expressions. Those things here. And the other thing is, in case that we need to talk about which variation of or which rule for a certain non-terminal we're talking about, we will identify them with the pair, which consists of the actual non-terminal that we want to talk about and the number of the rule variation that we want to talk about. So in case that we want to talk about the rule that that maps statement to while, so this variation over here, I would do that in the way statement, and then of course, we're computer scientists, so we start numbering with zero. So this would be statement one. So this is zero, and this is two, so to say. Okay. For grammars, grammars don't necessarily are one for or just one for a specific language. We can also have several grammars for the same language. Yeah, here you see me using the notation from before over here, so I'm numbering all my inputs. And these are grammars that I will probably come back to later on the slide. So it's just the usual expression grammars that you probably have encountered in your past at some point. So these are arithmetic expressions for those who have never seen these things before. And there's two variations of grammars that you can use for that. You can either use the first one or the second one. And they create things like that. So it's arithmetic expressions that you get out of that. And you can imagine that to be kind of a meaningful subset of a complete programming language for our purposes, but as we don't want to have our slides full of crap, we will probably just restrain ourselves to a very small fragment of the whole thing, and that's already sufficient to create a whole lot of fuss about. So, the next term that we need to talk about is the concept of derivation. I've probably already used a few names of that part now on the examples from the slides before, But anyway, these grammars are considered to be or to be interpreted as term rewriting systems, in the sense that you can do a rewrite steps one after each other, and the sequence of these steps is called a derivation. As an example, you would start with these ominous start symbols, of course. In our case, for the expression grammar, it's the E. And you would now, step by step, do a rewrite action at that point in order to come up with a derivation. So you could, for example, rewrite this non-terminal to the sentence form over here. So the things that are intermediate results of such derivations are called sentence forms. So that is something that we would get by one rewriting step, by rewriting E with the right-hand side E plus T, which was a particular variation of a rule for E of the, I think, the second example grammar. You can continue to rewrite the E with T, which was also a valid rewrite step, and could continue with rewriting the T with T times F. From there, you would continue rewriting this F, for example, with int in that case. Then you would, for example, decide to rewrite T into F, and that one into name, and then there's only T remaining, and you could rewrite it to F, and that one also to int. So that is a possible sequence of rewriting steps. Altogether, they would form a derivation, and yeah, at that point you can't continue anymore. So all in all, the derivation relation is a relation on words over n union t with such a derivation is or two of these words are in the derivation relation exactly if the first of these words has the form that it has a particular non-terminal here somewhere occurring in its sentence form, and the second one has a better occurring in its sentence form. And if you take this non-terminal, this sentence form better out of the picture, the context of both of them would be the same. That means that this alpha 1 needs to be the prefix of alpha as well as of alpha prime, and alpha 2 needs to be suffix of alpha and alpha prime, and they need to be prefixes and suffixes in the form that there's only a small hole, so to say, which is filled with the A in this case and with the beta in this case. So that is the first precondition. The second precondition is that you need to also have a rule that says that you can produce beta out of an A in our rule set. So if those two things are there, if I have those the words of that form, and if it happens to be that the only thing that differs in those two words are in are occurring in a production of our grammar, then we say that alpha and alpha prime are related via derivation. And you can do a transitive closure on the whole thing and consider the derivation relation star as several steps of derivations in there. Okay, with the derivation now we can define the language that is accepted as the input language for a certain well, not the input language, as the language that is the semantics for a certain grammar. So the relation, of course, is always depending on the grammar, of course, and it doesn't matter during the derivation process where we decide that we will rewrite or which variation of a rule we take for rewriting. It's a non-deterministic choice at that point, and all the things that we can reach with just derivation steps are considered to be contributing to the words that make up the language for the grammar. So everything that we can derive from the start state with arbitrarily many derivation steps, if there's only terminals remaining in the sentence form that we produce, then we consider those as terminals that are members of our semantics. Okay. So, yeah. Once again, the order in which we rewrite is not something that is important for the semantics of such a grammar. Next thing, derivation trees. So far you have seen me using the derivations in the form over here, in the kind of textual form. You can imagine these derivations as happening or unfolding as a tree structure that is kind of visualizing the structure that is hidden in our input words. So, for example, for a derivation that we have done on the slides before, we would realize that the corresponding derivation tree for that looks this way, and that would mean that our root symbol over here was the E, and the structural rule that we have used to start our derivation was the rule 0, that's why we put the 0 over here, which has produced this type of structure as the thing that depends on our root node. So what we have done here is we have connected this type of structure, this E plus T over here with the root node. So we have kind of unfolded that from the root node. And in there we still have other non-terminals. So there's the E and the T, and each of them also can still be kind of rewritten or have a derivation on, can be derived from. So, for example, in our case, we had the derivation from E, so this one would be would have a derivation, and it would be rewritten with rule number 1. So we put it this rule over here. This would result in producing a T at that point, which is reflected in here in the derivation tree, which can by itself then at some point be rewritten. I think that is directly over here with the 0, so we put that over here, which would produce T times F, which is this thing over here, and here, just for crap giggles, we would have decided over here that we would rewrite the F and not the T. So in our case, we would derive with a second alternative, providing us with int, which is the final terminal. So there's not any derivation step that we can do from a terminal anymore, so we don't keep a number over here. But you get the concept, I think. It's just a graphical notation of what we have done before. And you see also that by talking about the derivation trees, we remove the concept of a strict sequence of derivations over here. It does not matter whether we rewrite the F first or the T. Both of we could have done both of them in another sequence, and still gotten the same derivation tree. So derivation tree is something which is more stable in a certain sense than the sequence of derivation that is actually behind that. So there's several derivations possible for still the same derivation tree. In order, are interested in the actual derivation tree as the result of the parser, remember, we just want to have the syntactical structure. We're not actually interested in details like which of the nodes have been unfolded first. It just doesn't matter for the actual outcome of the resulting syntax tree. We need some way of talking about special derivations for kind of normal forms of derivations, and for that we concentrate on special derivations where we kind of establish the standard that. Whenever we see that in the sequence there is a certain derivation happening, it has to happen on the leftmost, for example, non-terminal that matches the left-hand side of the rule, or if you choose for the other standard, the rightmost occurrence of this non-terminal. So with that we have a kind of a standardized way of interpreting derivations with a certain derivation tree. So these leftmost and rightmost derivations are kind of important things, or well, left for leftmost and rightmost, we keep the L and the R because those will lead to different concepts of performing a parsing later on. These will, these will roughly correspond to these LL and LR parses later on. But that's probably too much for now. But keep in mind that's leftmost and rightmost, and it's talking about which of the occurrences of a non-terminal is chosen in case that there are several possibilities. So, apart from that, the leftmost or the rightmost derivations of a tree correspond to the first search traversals of the derivation tree, and they correspond to pre-order traversals in the case of leftmost and rightmost derivation. The only thing that differs if the actual siblings are visited right to left or left to right. So that makes up for leftmost or rightmost. There's also the concept of reverse, either rightmost or leftmost derivations. This is just the complete sequence of derivations reversed, and that corresponds to the post-order traversal of said tree. As an example, here's the tree from before, and now we can perform a depth-first search through these things, covering like that over here, which would lead to a leftmost derivation. So it's E0, E1, T0, T1, F1. Yeah, the name doesn't have anything to unfold, so there's no... this is already unfolded. So now we continue with F2, which is this one, then T1, and then F2. And that is the depth first search that descends from left to right through the siblings. That's the rightmost derivation, which also starts from start goes from E0 to T1 to F2 to E1 to T0 to F2 to T1 to F1. So that is also depth-first search, but that one descends through the rightmost sibling. Then there's the reverse rightmost derivation, which is just the rightmost derivation rewinded, and that one corresponds to F1 to T1 to F2 to T0 E1 F2 T1 E0. You know, so it's the same graph, but it's in kind of that direction here. Why is that so important? So maybe still talk about this one over here. These derivations later on will determine how the actual parsing engine will work. In the case that we have this leftmost derivation, remember we went like this one. This can be considered as an approach that starts from here, from the top, and goes down. So the derivation tree is created in a top-down fashion. And then there's the notion of the reverse leftmost derivation, which corresponds to this one over here, which can be considered to be a bottom-up parsing engine. And what both of them have in common, that they touch the leftmost input before they touch the more writer inputs. Same goes for the top-down one, where we had this direction over here. So that one was hit first, then this one, then this one, then this one, this one. So that is for both of them in common. So there's parsing concepts that go from left to right, so that contributes to the L. And if they pursue the leftmost derivation, they are called LL. They go through the input from left to right and do a leftmost derivation. And then there's the LR parsers, which do also go from left to right through the input, but do a reverse rightmost derivation. So these are the two parsing concepts that are out there. So that's why these derivation things are kind of important. Apart from that, what else is there to introduce? The concatenation of the leaves of a derivation tree is called the yield of a tree. So that is what will be the thing that's consumed afterwards with our parsers. So in our example, the yield would be name times int plus int. And then there's this concept of unique grammars. Grammars unique for every input, or if for every input there is maximally one derivation tree whose yield is actually corresponding to that input. Yeah, in our example with the first grammar, we can construct several derivation trees that still have the same yield. You can have a plus and a plus, and then it's an E that unfolds to a plus with an E and an E. And now we have the choice of either go like this in order to get the yield E plus E plus E, or you might instead also choose to unfold E plus E from here and get rid of that one over here. So you have two derivation trees from the same grammar, which have the same yield. So this grammar doesn't provide isn't unique. It doesn't provide one derivation tree for each input. The second one, however, is actually a unique grammar. For this one, you can only find one particular derivation for each yield. So that is, I think, everything about basics of grammars. That's what we have already talked about with the LL and the LR concepts of parsing. With that, there's still basics of pushdown automata, but I think that is a good topic for next time. So thank you for your attention. Oh, there's still a question up there.
How do we find if a grammar is unique?
We will detect that when we try to come up with an automaton for that. So there will be situations where we can see that it's not unique, but that's a little bit more than we can chew right now. Okay, good. So thank you, everyone, and have a nice tutorial.